Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay ahead with stories that really count. On our program today, just how close are we to a global recession as the Trump trade war continues? Cancer remains a major insurance worry in South Africa. We'll take a look at the world's wealthiest cities and where Johannesburg and Cape Town fit in, and what Gen Z and millennials are looking for in a modern employer. It's Friday, the 11th of April. I don't need to tell you that global tensions are rising once again, the United States hitting the world with a tariff shock dubbed Liberation Day. And while there's a temporary pause for some countries, the broader impact could be severe. So could this aggressive move tip the world's largest economy into recession? And what is it going to mean for South Africa? Joining us is Johan Els, Group Chief Economist at Old Mutual. He's just downgraded his US and South Africa growth forecasts in light of these developments. Johan, welcome. Thank you very much again for talking to us. So as I've just mentioned at the start, the US has paused tariff hikes for most countries. Maybe let's just start there. It is the latest news. Is this a pause or a pivot in your opinion? And where's the real global risk?
Yeah, I think it's still only a pause, but then policy making in the US have become so volatile that one cannot really say where this is heading. But it's certainly a global risk as well, because all of this has got a significant impact in terms of the rest of the world. I think Europe and China as the other two big global areas, though, have got some ammunition to at least support their policy. Policy ammunition to support the economies. In Germany, for instance, the incoming new leader has started scrapping some of the fiscal rules, and we'll see significant more defense spending in the whole of Europe as well. And China's got lots of room to cut taxes. So I think the scope for recessions in Europe and China is probably more limited than in the US.
So you've called a U.S. recession, Johan, your base case now. What are the clearest indicators right now, then, that are pointing in that direction?
So the U.S. economy has started slow from January 22 already. So even before this Trump presidency and policy volatility, this policy volatility on top of already slowing economy, in my mind, suggests that recession is coming. And as I said, I lifted my probability to around 65% of a U.S. recession within the next 6 to 12 months. Because what you typically see, and we're starting to see that in surveyed data, that businesses and consumers are putting spending decisions on hold. In other words, if there's so much uncertainty, and even with this last reversal or delay for 90 days of those tariffs, that's, again, in that box of policy uncertainty and volatility. Businesses put on hold any kind of spending decisions, whether that's employment or investment. And similar with consumers, why would you upgrade to a new car or better house if you're uncertain of what is going to happen in the US? And that's what's happening, and that spending on hold by consumers and businesses. And as I say, we see that in consumer sentiment and business sentiment. That's what's going to drive the economy into recession.
Johan, connect some economic theory dots for me, if you don't mind. My understanding is that higher tariffs would normally mean higher inflation. You're talking about disinflation.
Yeah, what I think, Jeremy, is going to happen is that similar to 2017, 2018, when tariff increases led to somewhat higher inflation, the Fed firstly said they're going to look through the initial uplift in inflation. And I think these tariffs will have a significant initial uplift in inflation in the US. But because I expect a recession, significantly weaker economic growth, the second round effect of those price increases will be severely limited by weaker economic growth. So we sit with a situation where central banks, who are typically looking forward, And in the US case, where the Fed is much more reactive in terms of danger signs for their economy than any other central bank in the world, I think the Fed will, despite short-term high inflation, realize that inflationary impact down the line because of weaker growth is much weaker. I think the Fed will start cutting rates from mid-year onwards.
And what does that then mean for global capital flow?
I think that that type of situation where, as I said, I expect better European growth because they're cutting their fiscal rules and starting to spend more, weaker US growth, Fed cutting rates. I think that's an environment where money will flow out of the US towards emerging markets and better returning investment destinations. So that means a weaker US dollar, in my opinion, similar to the trends we've seen over the last few weeks in terms of weakening of the dollar. I think that's then gone some legs in the dollar. Euro can drift towards 120. So it's not significant in terms of the type of levels we saw in the early 2000s, around 140, 150, but still a weaker dollar, that's good for emerging market currencies.
So South Africa could benefit then?
Well, I think so. I think we're a little bit better insulated, firstly, against the U.S. recession than perhaps what we were in the first trade war in 2017, 2018. We've seen some improvements in terms of easing the structural constraints in the economy around electricity and logistics. We're not there yet, but we're certainly moving in a better direction than what we were before. The cyclical side of the economy, low inflation, lower interest rates, that's also helping. And then if we overlay that, I've had lots of questions over the last week, inflationary impact in South Africa. You know, even with the weaker currency that we've seen, the oil price has fallen significantly more, so outweighing the weaker currency, so much so that the Rand oil price is down 13% since the start of April. That means we'll likely get more petrol price cuts over the next few months, which is good for inflation. And then if we look at a more stable Rand on the back of a weaker US dollar, of course, once the current extreme volatility settles a little bit, then I think no recession in South Africa, even though I've cut my forecasts a little bit, still easing structural constraints, cyclical side of the economy kicking in. And those exports of South Africa that goes to the US, it's less than 8% of our total exports. So it will have an impact, but it's not as if that 8% will fall to zero overnight. It will have a sectoral impact. Europe and China are doing relatively better than the US. It's not an all fall down situation. It's not a great situation.
Johan, having said that, though,
light at the end of the tunnel.
But having said that, though, there are certain sectors, I imagine, in the South African economy that are more vulnerable to these knock-on effects that you've outlined, most notably, I guess, the auto industry and agriculture, particularly citrus.
Yes, particularly citrus, and as I hear, some of the wine exports from the Western Cape as well. So certainly agriculture and vehicle manufacturing, I think there we'll probably see some support from government in terms of the motor industry development plan that supports the vehicle industry. And on the agricultural side, these farmers are well versed in finding other export opportunities. So perhaps not overnight, perhaps it takes a while, but I think we'll find other export destinations. The overall agricultural sector in South Africa should at least do a little bit better this year than last. We've got a better maize crop. That's by far the biggest agricultural component. And in the absence, perhaps, if we don't see a return of last year's avian flu and the foot and mouth disease, then agriculture overall should in any case be on a slightly better footing than last year.
Just a final one then. While we've been speaking about external factors, we've got to keep an eye on what is happening internally. Political stability within the GNU is obviously critical for confidence, and there will be an economic fallout if the DA exits this coalition. That will have an impact on the economy and growth possibly.
Yes, absolutely. So I'm absolutely hoping that the GNU can, both all of the parties can come to the senses and realize the potential negative impact on the economy if that should fall apart, or potentially continued positive impact if they actually stick together. But then obviously the GNU noise has had an impact on the Rand, but the bulk of the Rand impact, especially if we look at what happened in other currencies as well, and best examples probably the Aussie dollar and New Zealand dollar. They've moved similar to the Rand in recent weeks. So the bulk of the impact on the Rand was foreign events, US trade war events. But of course, I think the Rand will benefit from better news around sustainability of the GNU.
Thank you very much for talking to us. That is Johan Els, who is Group Chief Economist at Old Mutual. Always appreciate your time and your insight.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
This thought leadership interview is brought to you by Discovery Life. Secure your financial future and that of your family with comprehensive financial protection. Learn more at discovery.co.za. Discovery Life protection as unique as the life it covers. Now, Discovery Life paying out a record 11.5 billion rand in claims and benefits last year. But it's where the money went that is starting to reshape, I think, the life insurance conversation. With more payouts now linked to illness, disability and healthy lifestyle incentives than ever before, Discovery's shared value model may be changing how clients experience insurance in real time. And in that respect, I'm in conversation now with Gareth Friedlander, Deputy Chief Executive Officer at Discovery Life. I want to look at trends, numbers, and what they mean for the future of life cover. So Gareth, first of all, welcome. And that $11.5 billion in payouts, what does it signal, in your opinion, about the risk landscape that your company is currently navigating?
You know, I think the 11.5 billion is obviously a big number, but it's very much aligned to expectations. We've certainly come through the whole COVID spike in claims, and COVID is no longer a massive issue. There are a minor amount of COVID claims still in play, but from a risk perspective, definitely playing out in line with expectations. I think what's really exciting from our side, from a Discovery perspective, is the actual shared value payouts, as we call them, have been growing very, very strongly. So that's the money we pay back to clients just for being healthy and for being engaged in our vitality program. So certainly seeing some very, very positive trends in that space.
What behaviors then do you think are driving higher shared value rewards?
Yeah, so I think it's a number of kind of healthy activities. The program's evolved over many years now, to the point where we're actually, the latest launch of the program was what we call personalized health pathways, where we give each individual their specific next best action that they should perform based on their risk factors and what they've done to date. It's got an AI-driven element within it as well. So yeah, I think the science behind incentives and how we can change behavior has moved dramatically over the years. But for me, the biggest factor that drives it is the know your health component. So being able to drive clients to go for a vitality health check, to go for screenings, to really empower themselves and then their medical professionals with information about their risk factors and then to be able to address them immediately, that is unbelievably powerful. It's not like you can go for a run this afternoon and become healthy or drop your mortality rate tomorrow. But you can go for a health check and pick up that you have high cholesterol or diabetes, and you can address that literally instantaneously and bring down your risk dramatically. So we saw in 2024, Jeremy, that the actual mortality risk for our engaged clients, and that's our Gold and Diamond clients, was 57% lower than clients who weren't engaging in the program who weren't members of Vitality. And we see the same on the disability side, 47% lower disability risk. So really, really playing out very strongly at a kind of risk level for clients.
One interesting fact that has emerged is that cancer remains a top claim driver. What changes, Gareth, are you seeing in screening or early detection over the past year?
Yeah, cancer, as always, is a massive claims driver. It was the highest cause of death for women at 35% of our claims. It was the most common severe illness for both men and women at 57 and 31% respectively, and likewise in disability. So right across the broad spectrum of benefits, cancer is kind of ubiquitous and growing. But on the positive side, we've definitely been effective in driving clients to do more screening. So we've seen that our clients going for mammograms is up 14%, colorectal cancer screening up 29% since 2020, and likewise with prostate screening up 19%. All of them are at kind of all-time highs that we've seen in our client base. So that's really positive. It allows clients to pick up cancer at a much earlier stage, and obviously the survival rates and the treatment is much more effective when you can pick it up early. So all of that led to a 62% increase in our early stage cancer claims, which obviously is big payouts for clients. But the flip side from a discovery perspective is that you'll then get fewer death claims and fewer late-stage cancer claims. And we're starting to see that already come through. So we saw a 16% drop in the stage 4 cancer disability claims in 2024. So already, this will take time to come through in the stats, but already we're seeing that that increased screening is starting to move clients towards picking that cancer up earlier.
And just a quick one in conclusion, how then do you see the balance shifting between death cover and living benefits over the next 5 years? And in that respect then, what should financial advisors be telling their clients given the trends that you've just outlined?
You know, as I mentioned with the shared value model pulling down those mortality and morbidity rates, we're able to then turn that into money as an insurer through the shared value model. And what that looks like for clients are these payback benefits and cash conversion benefits. We paid out 2.4 billion rand in 2024 under those benefits to clients just for living healthily. And that really is kind of a change in the paradigm of insurance, whereby it's about having, you know, protection for the worst of times for you and your family, but then also being really rewarded richly for positive behavior change. So we expect that to continue to grow over the coming years. And, you know, we're seeing the trajectory growth rate of those kind of payouts, shared value payouts for healthy clients growing at a much faster rate than the claims payouts for our clients who are obviously claimants or passing away. From a financial advisor perspective, you know, I think it's to look at comprehensive protection, look at protection that's future-proofed, but then, you know, embracing these trends, the ability to save lives, to change your client's lifestyle is just so powerful for financial advisors and will play out in a value proposition that is immense for your clients.
Gareth Friedlander, Deputy Chief Executive Officer, Discovery Life, thank you very much indeed. And this thought leadership interview was brought to you by Discovery Life. Ask your financial advisor for more details or find out more on discovery.co.za. Discovery Life, protection as unique as the life it covers.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The global landscape of wealth is shifting, with certain cities emerging as new hubs for the affluent. The new World Wealthiest Cities Report 2025, published by Henley & Partners in collaboration with New World Wealth, really offers a comprehensive analysis of these trends. Now, notably, Cape Town has been highlighted as a significant player, with projections indicating a potential doubling of its ultra-wealthy population within the next 10 years or so. No real surprises there, but let's delve deeper into the report, into the findings. Joining me now is Andrew Amoyles, Head of Research at New World Wealth. So, Andrew, welcome. And the report indicates, as I've just said, that Cape Town's population of so-called centi-millionaires could double in a decade. What specific factors are driving this anticipated growth?
Yes, Cape Town and also the Cape Winelands nearby has obviously been growing quite quickly the last decade in terms of growth. But going forward, our projections were expecting US dollar millionaire growth of over 100% over the next decade. The combination of factors, obviously, emigration of wealthy people from other parts of South Africa. Also, a lot of wealthy people are returning and also moving from places in the UK and Europe. So those are probably the main drivers. Also, there's obviously quite a fast-growing fintech sector in Cape Town, and that's helping the growth.
Now, Cape Town, as you point out, is showing a huge amount of potential, a huge amount of promise, but no surprises here. Johannesburg still holds the title of Africa's wealthiest city. It would be interesting to know what dynamics then are at play between the two cities in terms of wealth and distribution growth.
Yes, Johannesburg still ranks above Cape Town when it comes to the millionaires, so the typical millionaires, which is a US dollar millionaire in liquid wealth. So someone with around 20 million rand in liquid wealth. So that Johannesburg is still the leader over Cape Town. I think there's a number of reasons for that. It's most of the big JSE top 30 companies are based in Johannesburg. But when it comes to the higher wealth bands, like the billionaires and the centi-millionaires with over 100 million US dollars, Cape Town is actually quite far ahead of Johannesburg now.
Now, the report also, Andrew, indicates significant millionaire growth in cities like Shenzhen and also Dubai. So I'm wondering then if there are lessons maybe that Cape Town could learn from these cities to attract and retain, I guess, high net worth individuals.
I think definitely. I mean, Shenzhen is obviously a major tech hub now. It's the industry leader in certain areas of tech, computer components, electronic transportation, portable electronics, unmanned vehicles, 5G, and a few others. Silicon Valley obviously still leads in software development and AI and microchips and things like that. So Cape Town has quite a fast-growing fintech sector, so it could draw from that. And in terms of Dubai, Dubai is obviously seen as a safe haven city, and also it's quite competitive tax rates. Cape Town could probably try and copy that. And also in terms of helping wealthy people move to the city and encouraging them to do so, Cape Town could probably look at some of the things Dubai's done and try and replicate that.
I want to continue drawing comparisons between the rest of the report and Cape Town as we center this in South Africa. And again, conversely, cities like London and Moscow have seen declines in their millionaire population. So what would the reason be for that? And again, I'm wondering whether Cape Town and even Johannesburg, for that reason, what pitfalls they should be wary of to avoid similar trends?
Well, Moscow's obviously been hurt by the sanctions that have been on Russia for some time now. And obviously, since the invasion of Ukraine, those sanctions have got heavier. And a lot of wealthy people have left Russia. So that's obviously impacted negatively on them. In terms of London, that's a larger story. I think there's a lot of things at play. Obviously, Brexit came into the period that we're looking at, the decade, because we're going from 2014 to now. So that would have caused the decline. Also, quite a lot of wealthy people have left the UK, not just because of Brexit, because they got quite high tax rates. And the NHS, the National Health Service in the UK, is deteriorated, which is often mentioned by a lot of people we speak to as one of the reasons why wealthy people are leaving.
From what I can see here, it's all about retention. And the report mentions that cities with investment migration programs tend to attract more affluent individuals. What specifically are we talking about in that respect?
Well, there's a number of factors there. I mean, there are programs that actually encourage people can buy into where it helps them get into a country. Also, a lot of countries make it quite easy for wealthy people to move there, where some don't. Some countries, for instance, Australia, used to focus very much on wealthy people. They wanted wealthy people. They wanted to know how much money you had in your bank account, whereas now they've moved more towards just wanting people under the age of 40. So it depends. But I think most of the cities on the list are countries that have investment migration programs and are actively trying to get wealthy people to move there, definitely.
This next question really is a hot potato, and I think Cape Town is very aware of it. The anticipated influx of wealth, as you referred to a little earlier, is understandable, but there are concerns about rising inequality and gentrification. So how can a city like Cape Town balance economic growth, which is critical, along with social equity? And again, with respect, it's also a challenge, I guess, that many other cities around the world that are on an upward trajectory also face.
Yes, that's a tricky question. In terms of you know, obviously there's wealthy people set up foundations and things like that to try and help that. So you could argue that having a lot of wealthy people might help that in a way, although it is obviously if you've got a lot of wealthy people and you've got a lot of poorer people in a city, it does sometimes come across as very unequal. But to be honest, I don't have a lot of ideas on that. I think that's one of those questions quite difficult to answer.
Just quickly then, given the current global economic volatility that we're experiencing, and we've reported on that in some detail on the program tonight, how resilient do you think Cape Town's wealth growth projection is in the face of these financial downturns that we're seeing?
Yeah, that's the big question. Obviously, with the US and the tariffs, it's definitely a factor. And the Rand has struggled against the dollar recently. The Euro's done quite well against the dollar this year, which is interesting. The Rand has been one of those currencies that struggled, and the local stock market hasn't done that well. So that's definitely a concern. And yeah, it could definitely impact on our projections if the US and South Africa's relationship continues to deteriorate. That would negatively impact on Cape Town's wealth growth going forward, definitely.
Well, the research is called the World's Wealthiest Cities Report 2025. It's published by Henley along with New World Wealth. I've been in conversation with Andrew Amoyles, Head of Research at New World Wealth. Andrew, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
So-called Generation Z and millennials are rapidly transforming South Africa's workplace dynamics, I read. For these younger professionals, career success isn't just about tenure or titles. It's about purpose, flexibility, learning, and impact. And this shift is challenging employers to rethink traditional reward structures, performance evaluations, and career paths. So how should organizations be responding in that respect? I'm talking now to Dion Smit, Master Reward Specialist and Executive Committee Member at the South African Reward Association. I want to discuss what these shifts mean and what employers must do urgently, I guess, to stay competitive in an evolving war for talent. Dion, a very warm welcome. It's fair to say then that South African companies, I think, are still rewarding loyalty and seniority, but there's a different game at play, isn't there?
That's correct, Jeremy. Thanks for having me. I think that South African organizations sometimes get a bit stuck in old models, and with new generations pushing into the workplace, we already have at least 10 years of Gen Z in the workplace, from 18 to about 28 years. And most of the millennials are starting to move into middle to senior management in organizations. And they are much more demanding about what employers provide for them as part of their reward packages, but also in terms of their work environment.
So let me put this to you, and I want to focus specifically on that word purpose-driven work and real-time recognition, I think is another request that this cohort has. How would you, Dion, respond to employers who dismiss this and they say it's just entitlement and we're not prepared to play in that space?
I think those employees will struggle to find talent in the future. Purpose-driven work means that people want to work for something they believe in or can get behind, or they see the values that they feel is important to them in the organization. And what will happen, people will talk with their feet. They hire turnover in these organizations that aren't willing to adapt. And the same is with recognition. Gen Z and millennials want more feedback, more consistent feedback, regular check-ins. They can't wait for annual performance review. And if organizations aren't putting that on the table or providing them that with that almost affirmation sessions and confirmation that they're on the right path, even with mentorship in the workplace, they will find an organization that do match their values and they can work with and adding value to not just them, but also to society at large.
A difficulty, though, surely, Dion, is not all companies can provide purpose-driven work.
I think that it comes down to every individual. I think it is about what your organization is changing. You know, can you get behind the mission of what your organization is doing? And you're right, it's not always as easy for people. Some people don't have a choice. They're finding something that they have to do to put food on the table. But even organizations like that, they're doing a business for a reason. They're adding value. They're contributing to the economy in a certain way. And is your product, is your service changing the lives of people for the better? And I think that is important. And that any employee can get behind that if they can see that their employer is making a difference in the delivery of the products that they create.
If traditional annual bonuses and performance reviews, as you've suggested, are no longer high on the priority, one, do they play any role at all? And how do employers need to rethink their approach to that type of reward?
I think that employees would like things that are more flexible and nuanced towards what they are doing. I think some annual bonuses, some people can't tell you how they calculate it. You just get it at the end of the year. I think people want to work towards their own goals. They're much more self-driven. And I think bonuses should be the same. And it can also change in increments. It doesn't have to be an annual bonus. It could be quarterly. It could be monthly. It all depends what target you're driven. And I think the younger generations want those targets. They're not, I think a lot of people label them lazy. They just work differently. And I think employers need to embrace that they need to be able to adjust their systems, not stay with the status quo of how things have worked, and look for creative ways then to remunerate employees on that level. Because they would like to. And of course, employees doesn't want to stay for 10 years, collect a long service award. Employees don't think like that anymore. They have changed their way of thinking. They will move in an instant if they can find something that will align better with themselves, or they see an opportunity for themselves for career growth.
I think my next question comes back to alignment and purpose. We know that South Africa is still a deeply unequal society. So DEI, diversity, equity and inclusion expectations, particularly as far as Gen Z is concerned, how much of a disconnect there or is there with the realities of many corporate cultures? Again, it comes back to finding that singular or unified purpose.
I think that's important for where employers come in, is to create the environment that makes everybody feel welcome. And I think that is important. I think a lot of barriers have been broken down, but there's still a lot of work that needs to get done. And I think what Gen Z and millennials, they've grown up in a much more diverse and multicultural society and gender equality. So I think for them, it's easier. And by just being in the workplace, they're already pushing for change in that environment, a more inclusive environment of thoughts. And in increase in diverse thoughts actually creates greater productivity and innovation in an organization. And I think that it's easier for some corporates maybe to stay in the status quo because it's what they've known. But unfortunately, Gen Z and millennials is going to push them hard, and they're going to break that silo. It's definitely in the future. So I think just by being in corporates, they're really going to shake the walls a bit and make changes for the better.
And just a quick one in conclusion, what are the risks for organizations if they don't change?
Well, I think that the risk will be that people will go and they will alienate this generation and they will lose the skills. This is a very connected generation, and they will struggle to actually be sustained over a long period of time because people wouldn't want to work there. Their culture is going to be impacted in the long term, and it's going to impact your company's growth and sustainability of what you can deliver to your customers, if that is the case.
Dion Smit, I'm going to leave it there with my thanks, Executive Committee Member at the South African Reward Association. And that's MoneyWeb at midday for today. We're back on Monday, live at noon, and then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.